This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Tim and Sid.
From his summer camp, Blue Jays general manager Ross Atkins. Not really the same old summer camp that we all grew up with, was it?
No, not the same. I didn't have much summer camp in my life. But I can just zoom you guys in. I will just go FaceTime for the next couple of hours.
There you go. Ross, you're a golfer. Tiger's going to play the Memorial next weekend. If he's in the hunt on Saturday and Sunday, how much are you paying attention to that?
Yeah, you know what I do? I appreciate all live sports, and I will certainly tune in when I can. I wouldn't call myself a golfer. I play once a year. I played a little bit in the past, but I do really appreciate and respect the sport, and I was interested to hear you guys talking about that. Also, you know, fascinating to think about athletes' decisions to play or to not to play, and that adrenaline that athletes live upon and need. I talk so often with athletes and former athletes just about how they manage that, especially, you know, former athletes dealing with not being able to compete, not being able to get that adrenaline level to those levels that they're accustomed to. And that's why, you know, in my opinion, Tiger's gonna, you know, he wants to be there.
Without a doubt. Like me saying, why don't you sit down for the rest of the year is very easy for me to say. And for him, you know, he is just chomp. Like, as the competitor that, and maybe one of the greatest competitors of our lifetime, like, as the competitor he is, he's just chomping at the bit to get back out there.
There's no doubt.
How has the overall outlook on your chances to compete in 22 changed with the way this breaks down and the way we enter Major League Baseball's return to play?
Yeah, it's been interesting, really. Like, I'm so encouraged by our players, and I speak for the industry there. Just you see the behavior of players and how much respect they have for the protocols, for the process, for the virus, for all of the circumstance, really. That will be why we are successful. It, you know, testing is a key part of it. I think just as important is the players' complete buy-in to the protocols. They're, you know, placing the appropriate level of seriousness on this situation and circumstance. And that's what we've seen across the game. Certainly have seen it for the Toronto Blue Jays. We are extremely encouraged by our players' reaction, the immediate turnaround of testing results, and you know, really what we've seen from a mindset, attitude, and outcome thus far. And in speaking of, you know, it's just so interesting. I was thinking about, as you guys were talking about golf, someone said to me a long time ago about when you're playing with a competitor, and it was on the golf course, someone said this to me, you know very quickly about yourself and the competitor and how they deal with a challenge. Do they walk up to an uphill sand shot at 90 yards and say, I can't wait to hit this? Or do they talk about their misfortune or luck? And to see our team right now talking about our circumstances as an opportunity, because we will have, now that we are having camp here, the restrictions that are placed upon us are more strict than they are for other teams. And our players are talking about that as an opportunity to make us more competitive. And it's that mindset that is very, very telling for organizations and teams that do exceptional things. And it's been really encouraging for us and a lot of fun, really, to be around.
So, Ross, let's talk about a couple of those guys. With the caveat that the virus hopefully doesn't affect anybody, but especially them, a lot of Blue Jay fans know Bichette, they know Biggio, you know, they know Ryu, they know Guerrero and the rest. Who are a couple of dudes under the radar that maybe aren't household names that you think could emerge this season in a shortened 60-game schedule that could make an impact in a sprint and not a marathon?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the pitchers are, we're really excited about our pitching depth, and a lot of it is, you know, to say unproven, is unproven at the major league level. The really good AAA, AA track records, and a lot of reasons to believe they will be successful in the major leagues, and really dependent upon just opportunity and health. Durability is such a huge component for pitching. So that's what first and foremost comes to mind. Excuse me, but you know, the interesting thing is, you know, we don't talk about Lourdes Gurriel nearly as much as we talk about the names that you just mentioned. I know he's not who you were pointing me to with your question, but I just want to make sure that we do bring him up just because of just what an exceptional talent he is. And we feel like he's really on an upswing. And he has had some soft tissue injuries. And then last year at the end of the season, just circumstance and bad luck. But man, he's probably in the best shape of any of our players right now, and wanted to make sure that I called attention to it. He is, really a remarkable talent. It was fascinating to watch how he took this time down to really maximize it. But I really think it's going to be the pitching that shines for us as we think about the unheralded names, and you know, one of them, Nate Pearson, and. That one is not unheralded by any means, but has not yet pitched in the major leagues. The interesting thing about our situation right now is that we don't have other development opportunities for guys. So we're going to have to really think about how we maximize this environment while we're trying to win every night. And, first and foremost, it's win. But then secondarily, thinking about where the development opportunities are and what is the opportunity cost of having someone maybe potentially move to a bullpen role, using the piggyback as a way to tap into our pitching depth when the rosters are expanded. But it really is going to come down to that body, unless calling out one or two names.
Ross Atkins joining us here on Tim and Sid with Arash Madani. A couple months ago, we were joking with Mark Shapiro about begging for the day where we would be able to ask the Nate Pearson questions once again. Well, here we are. We're at that day. And he obviously had a pretty damn good spring. But how will you know, and you're getting this question a ton and we understand it, but how do you know if he's ready to break summer camp with this team?
Yeah, I mean, usually it's really hard in a spring setting to really know for sure. And that's why we talk so much about the value of him pitching in AAA for some time and getting an extended look at that level and maximizing every opportunity there. So, and then you couple that with, we're going to have several inter-squad games. We will play exhibition games. It's going to be difficult to know for sure. And then you're always thinking about someone making their debut on opening day and the added pressure of that. So, it's never wrapped well, and not never, but coming out of spring training for a player making their debut, it's never wrapped with a bow on top, where oftentimes it really is, where you're just getting out of the way and letting someone join your team because it is wrapped and has a bow on top and the player has made the decision for you. And as you guys know, you not just in this sport, but across every sport, it's a very different environment when the stats and the score and the wins and losses don't matter. Not don't matter altogether, but don't end up being a part of history. So, we'll see. We're so excited to have this group here, that not just Nate Pearson, but a lot of the pitching depth that we do that are learning from Rue and Shoemaker and Chase Anderson and Tanner Roark every day, and going to continue to grow and get better. And our pitching has really stood out in how they've just taken advantage of this time down. It's a little bit easier to do as a pitcher because, you can get a lot of productive work done with a mound and a plate and a catcher.
With Ryu, Ross, I mean, nobody was more of a ready-made gift wrapped in a bow, ready to rock, than him when you guys landed him. He knows his routine. He knows how he needs to get ready for a season. He's on his own track. He does his own thing. And then a pandemic hits and everything gets turned upside down. What has he been doing for the last 4 months to have himself ready?
He's been awesome. Man, I can't say enough about, if you think about someone living not in an altogether new country, but a certainly country that's not his home, and then moves to a new city for spring training that he's never been to, joins a completely new organization, a new team, doesn't command the English language, so has to communicate not entirely through a translator, but oftentimes through that. It's no wonder he's been so successful. He's as consistent as they come. He is very steady, easygoing. He makes others feel very comfortable around him. and he loves to compete and he loves to work. So those are the types of things that not everyone's born with. And, you know, fortunately, he has some incredible attributes, and he's grown, he's matured over his career through dealing with the injuries and having to have made some adjustments. And all through that, all the things I just described was bringing his wife into a new environment to deliver a new baby girl and another country and a new state and a foreign city. So, you know, he's in great shape. He looks fantastic. He's going to be stretched out and ready to go for opening day if we don't have any significant setbacks. And man, are we glad to have him. He's a joy to be around.
How do you manage, Ross? You talk about opening day and arms being stretched out. How do you now manage a pitching staff when guys have not getting the full spring training, so to speak? How does the workload now get figured out, if you will?
Yeah, you know, I think it's the workload is one aspect of it that you want to try to make sure you're keeping workload on. You know, looking for opportunities to do that while we're also managing the wear and tear. So there's always a balance with that. And it's also very difficult to ask someone in non-competitive environments to go out and throw 5 and 6 innings of simulated games and for that to really be that productive on different adrenaline levels. So, you know, for every player, and I know this is not the most fun answer, but it really has been different for every single player, based on their circumstances, based on the resources they had, and then based on what motivated them and helped them stay in the right mindset, and then opportunities they had just to get better. So over the course of the next, you know, 2 weeks, really, we're going to double down on all the things that we've been doing and take those that really kept workloads down a bit and build them up so that they're in a comfortable position to add depth. The one thing that we need to be cognizant of and making sure we're covered for is the potential of having someone test positive and how that impacts our starting rotation and making sure that safety is at the forefront. So we'll have, you know, a lot of our guys built up and stretched out, and we'll be open-minded about how we tap into the 40-man roster to build that 30-man. And, you know, again, it won't be too untraditional, or it will be relatively traditional as they build up as it relates to innings over the next 2 weeks. You know, they'll be adding an inning to an inning and a half based on pitch count over each outing.
Ross Atkins here on Tim and Sid with Arash Madani. Ross, you're talking about strategizing, and it, to me, as I hear you speak of it, I'm thinking, damn, there's got to be like 15 different, you know, 15. It might be infinite number of possibilities that you're going through. How much does knowing where you'll play your home games and then the strategies that you'll have to prepare for whatever that means in the future as well? Like, do you know when you're going to know if you'll play your home games in Toronto?
You know, so the first question and how that plays into strategy is we're first and foremost, as it relates to pitching, thinking about depth. So that will be consistent wherever we're pitching and wherever we're playing. As we create matchups, you know, the ballpark comes into play for sure. And that will, right, that's relatively easy to adjust, you know, at the time to build your roster. And by the time we make decisions on our roster, we will definitely know. We're certainly not going to put firm deadlines on it ourselves, because we would very much like to be in Toronto and want to keep every avenue open to make that happen as we contingency plan in other places.
Listen to more of Tim and Sid weekdays from 5 to 7. Coming up, more Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Good Show with Ben Ennis and J.D. Bunkus.
Let's talk to Jordan Hamilton, Canadian forward for the Columbus Crew. He's also a member of MLS's Black Players for Change Alliance. Hey, Jordan, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
Hi, no problem.
So we discussed just off the top of the show the demonstration before the opening match yesterday. Obviously, you were involved in the planning for that thing. What did you think of how it actually looked?
Well, I think it came together pretty well. I think the timing showed how long of a time 8 minutes can be, and that's how long George Floyd had a foot on his neck. So I think we got our point across, and I think it was a beautiful demonstration of unity.
Yeah, how much talk among players and among the league happened beforehand to kind of decide what and how you were going to execute what we saw yesterday?
Yeah, I think we planned it maybe starting a month ago, or like as soon as, like while the protests were going on, we were all getting on Zoom calls, trying to put together ideas of and seeing what's politically correct and t-shirts and whatnot, and just putting everything together through Zoom with all the black players in the league. And I think it worked out pretty well.
So maybe clarify that with us, because that was our part of our conversation as well off the top of the show, saying you wanted to make sure it was politically correct. Were there guidelines handed to you by MLS? Were there things that were maybe controversial that you didn't want to say? What do you mean when you say you were looking at things that were politically correct?
The MLS was very supportive, kind of gave us the green light to do whatever we thought was necessary, and they showed full support. So they were fully on board with whatever we wanted to do, and we just wanted to do something that would get the message across and just in the right way without being too controversial and get the right message across.
How has it been received? What have you heard from other athletes? What have you seen socially? Because in a way, you still are putting yourself out there.
I've anything I've read or heard has been positive. I thought it was a good demonstration, and like I said, I thought we showed a lot of unity and just that there will be a change within the league and hopefully within the world.
Is there going to be something before every game, or was that just that, you know, before the tournament gets underway, you wanted to do something of that magnitude?
Well, I think that was just the main statement, just before the first game, to have all the black players and staff members come out and show unity. And I think before the New York game just now, I think that they kneeled again, just the players, but That was the main statement, I'm pretty sure.
So you're a member of the MLS's Black Players for Change Alliance and Coalition. Aside from showing the unity in the sport, what are you guys looking to get done? What are the tangible things that you want to see changed within the sport and within society?
Just give black players a voice, you know. I'm not a part of the board, but I'm a black player in MLS, and I try to take part in all the calls and stuff just to keep myself informed. But they just want a voice in the league, right? Because we don't really have representation. I think the NFL has a black players coalition. So I think we're following in their footsteps, and They just want a voice, and they just want to be heard. And with everything going on in the world and in America right now, I think it's a perfect time to get it together and just show that we're willing to.
Talking to Jordan Hamilton, Canadian forward for the Columbus Crew. You're still waiting to play your first game, Jordan. It's been a very weird start to this bubble, right? We've had games canceled. We had teams withdraw. We don't still know what's going to happen with Nashville. They've had 9 positive tests, and Dallas had 10 and removed themselves from this tournament. How do you feel from like a safety level down there?
It's a scary thing, right? The virus... some people can get it and be in the hospital, and some people can get it and not feel anything, right? So it's a very strange thing. The league, the protocol the league has in place and the hotel, they've really made a genuine effort, I would say, to have everything feel safe. And, you know, a lot of guys are just happy to be back playing soccer. Me personally, you know, I don't have a girlfriend or a child or a family. So, I mean, I obviously have a family like back home, but not someone that relies on me. And so it for me personally, I'm happy to be back playing soccer. But for somebody who has a child and a wife, it can be something that I can't speak on and a feeling that I can't speak on. So, yeah, it's a weird one for some people for sure. But at the end of the day, it's a job too, right?
100%. The extended Hamilton family was like, excuse me? What do you mean you don't have a family?
We're not family?
Yeah.
Dog, you got to keep it real. No, I mean, this is I mean, we're living through a history lesson, to be quite honest. And this is uprooting many lives and businesses and economies. And what's this been like for you as an athlete, you know, coming up to, if not in your physical prime, getting ready for a season that starts and then stops? Now you're in this tournament for maybe a short time or a long time, and then you kind of still don't really know what's going to happen with the rest of the season. Just mentally, what has this entire process been like for you?
You know, it's been difficult, obviously, because you go into a preseason and you prepare for the season, and then you play two games, and then all of a sudden, it's over pretty much for two to 3 months. For me personally, I was just by myself every day in a town that I'm not overly familiar with like no family and friends. So I just kind of used the time to kind of like look myself in the mirror at what I need to improve it with myself and just really attacked it. Because I had the time to, and with nothing else to do, you know, I'm not just going to sit there and waste 2 or 3 months. So I just really focused on my body and mind, and I think I came out better for it. So as I've seen a lot of other athletes have done as well, I mean, you look around different sports and you see guys change their bodies or whatever they felt was necessary to make themselves a better player. And I think I also did that over the time of the quarantine.
Yeah. Yeah, Marc Gasol is a male model now. So yeah. No, yeah. A lot of guys have used this time wisely. So Jordan, social media loves the pictures of the meals guys are getting in the bubble. The NBA. We've had so much discourse about the boxed meal that they got. Before that, it was you guys and the sandwiches in the box. And yes, we understood that perhaps it would be different after the 12-hour quarantine period. How was the food? Give us the skinny on the food, Jordan.
Oh, man. Well, let's just say I had Uber Eats for the first time last night, and it was finished in maybe 5 minutes.
What was the order?
But sometimes it's not horrible, honestly, but sometimes it is pretty bad. But they're trying, you know. You just gotta kind of maybe go overkill on the salt and pepper a bit just to give it some flavor. But I mean, it's fuel, right? At the end of the day, we're training hard, so it's just, you got to just look at it as fuel at some point and just kind of get over it, right? Because it is what it is, and it's not going to be perfect, but that's what I could say pretty much.
We got to FedEx you some hot sauce and some Diana sauce just to be able to add a little flavor to your situation.
Yeah, so, I saw one player brought a portable stovetop and a pan and some seasoning, and I was like, wow, what a great idea.
I think we found like some content for you. You could like, you know, have your own little cooking special throughout your time in the bubble. One of the things we've heard from Major League Baseball players is we were told that this is going to be a certain way, a certain situation, and it hasn't been that way across the board. Have there been some things that you thought were going to be the case and haven't? And on the flip side, have there been some things that you were surprised about the level that they're at when you thought they weren't going to be as good?
Honestly, I'm pretty pleased with the hotel and the amenities they've put together. I mean, I think every team has 3 lounge rooms with different things for guys to do, like ping pong, arcade games, or PlayStations, poker tables. Like they've really put effort into giving guys things to do, and the fields are amazing. I mean, it's Florida, so the grass is top notch, and it just honestly just feels good to be out playing again. So I'm happy personally with the things that they've gone overboard to try and make guys feel like they have stuff to do. But this is coming from a 24-year-old, so there's other guys who might feel differently. So this is just my opinion on it. But I'm happy with it.
Yeah, no, that's great. We are talking to Jordan Hamilton, Canadian forward for the Columbus Crew, and Jordan, also a member of the MLS's Black Players for Change Alliance and Coalition. So what safeguards are in place to keep guys on the compound? Because we understand, like, you're in the you know, Disney Wild World of Sports compound there, but you're in the middle of a state in which it's been an absolute disaster when it comes to the disease. Mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine there's not a lot of guys that are like, hey, you know what? Let's go out into that cesspool of the virus right now. Is that all it takes, or is there actually something in place to make sure guys don't go there? What's the situation?
I mean, and tell you, because that's the last thing I want to do, and because I think guys see the positive testing and what the effect it can have on your team and on you personally, because guys want to play, right? So one positive test, and I think you're out for 2 weeks, which is maybe half of the tournament already. So I don't think personally guys would try and leave. Just solely because of the risk associated with, obviously in Orlando you see on the news every day that there's over 5,000 cases every day almost. So it's a pretty crazy thing to witness. And but at the same time, we're secluded over here in this part of Disney World, and I personally haven't tried to leave outside of going to the bus to go to practice, so I don't know what's in place, but I imagine that guys wouldn't be naive enough to try and do that.
How close are you to the NBA guys? Can you see them from where you are? Like, do you know what's going on over there?
I have no idea where they are. This is, I think, the last time I was at Disney World was 15 for TFC's preseason, but so I'm not too familiar with the layout, but I'm sure that once we start going in for games and inside the locker areas and stuff, we'll see them, because I'm pretty sure the locker room area is in the gymnasium where they play basketball. So maybe we'll start to see them, but I haven't seen any of them personally, but it would be cool to.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you can give us an update on that when you do. Jordan, appreciate the time. Keep doing the Uber Eats thing, just a lot of salt and pepper. That makes a whole lot of sense. If I learned anything from Seinfeld and Frank Costanza, that can make any food edible. Just throw a lot of spices on it. Thanks, Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah. No problem. Thank you, guys.
Listen to more of Good Show with Ben Ennis and J.D. Bunkus weekday mornings from 9 to noon. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Hockey Central.
As we're going through all the preliminary round series, I want to get to this Islanders-Florida Panthers matchup, but as we bring on George Richards from Florida Hockey Now, there is more to Florida right now than just a preliminary round series with the New York Islanders. First of all, George, thanks so much for dropping by again. Much appreciated, and it's always nice to catch up with you. What now? So Chris Pronger leaves the organization, now formerly Senior VP of Hockey Operations, to go and assist in the family business, which is a luxury travel company. 3 years with the Florida Panthers. He's always had designs to be a general manager. I want to read in between the lines here, George. Should I?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like he just wants to be his own boss. I mean, you know, he's getting this family business going with his wife. Obviously, she's got some experience in that field, and he wants to devote his time. I mean, he said in a story with The Athletic after the news broke yesterday that he probably could have stayed with Florida, but he didn't want to, you know, kind of go half in, half out. He wanted to delve into this business full bore and not, you know, take away from the Panthers and his responsibilities there. So good luck to him. You know, I know he's held in high regard within the not only the Florida Panthers, but the entire National Hockey League. He worked in the league's front office before coming to Florida. So, you know, if he ever wants to get back into, an NHL front office, I don't think Chris Pronger is going to have any problem doing that.
Stewie?
George, how are you doing? How are you?
Hey, Stewie. Good to hear from you, my man.
Good, good, good. I just want to ask about some South Florida minor hockey business before we get to the Florida Panthers.
You do?
Yes, I was reading recently that the South Florida Hockey Academy, the Oliokin and Radek Dvorak and Thomas Vokoun have broken off. What's the 411 on there, and what do we expect from them in the coming months and years?
Yeah, it sounds like they had a nasty breakup with the Panthers. You know, it was quite ballyhooed when Ole Jokinen and his South Florida Hockey Academy joined forces with the Panthers a couple years ago. There was an out where both sides could break it off after 2 years. The Panthers apparently made an offer to buy it from Ole and his partners, like you said, Thomas Vokoun. And Radek Dvorak, you know, former Panthers, as you know, and they turned it down. So right now it sounds like they've got some kind of, you know, new rink being built up in Palm Beach County that they're going to try and find a home. They can't do anything right now anyway, from what I've been told. Everything's at a standstill. So, you know, I know it wasn't I know Ole hasn't been happy with the organization. You know, he didn't go to, you know what, I don't even think he was invited to the Roberto Luongo retirement ceremony. So there's definitely been some acrimony between Ole Jokinen, former Panther captain, and the Florida Panther organization.
Justin?
Hey, George, thanks for coming on today. I'm hoping you can help us a little. I hope you can help us out a little bit with making sense of this Florida Panthers team, who goes into this play-in round as a 10 seed. But every year, I feel like we're looking at this team, and it's like Barkov and Huberdeau, and they've got Ekblad and Yandel and Strollman. Like, there's tons of good players. And every year, it seems like, boy, look out for the Panthers, and they aren't able to quite take that step. Is there more there with this Florida Panthers group, or what is it that's keeping them from sort of realizing what looks like a lot of potential?
Yeah, I mean, they spent a ton of money and, you know, thought that everything was going to be fixed. Now, you talk about Sergei Bobrovsky and the disappointing season he had. I mean, there was a lot of changes going on. Not only, you know, you had the pressure of, that huge contract, the biggest contract the Florida Panthers have ever given out. You have an absolutely different system in front of him than he was used to playing in front of in Columbus. You watch Columbus play hockey, and it is, you know, completely different from the way the Panthers do. So I think there was definitely an adjustment period that never really clicked. But now that they get a couple weeks here with a you know, training camp and getting back to the way they were playing before the hiatus, I think watch out for Sergei Bobrovsky. I think we're going to see the old school Bob instead of this year's version.
Being joined by George Richards, previewing the Florida Panthers and the New York Islanders. Well, one other preliminary play-in round series. One name that was quite prominent back when Tom Rowe was coaching the team is Eric Joyce. And he was always sort of looked at in the organization as the next general manager. When he's ready, he's going to take over, and this is going to be Eric Joyce's team. It's kind of gone quiet the last couple of years around Eric Joyce. How is he seen in the organization now, George?
Oh, I think, you know, Eric Joyce is the assistant general manager. He's in charge of the AHL team, which the last couple of years has been in Springfield, Massachusetts. And, I think Eric Joyce was a rising guy in the organization, during the Tom Rowe year, 2016-17. He was able to survive all that. I think he's a trusted guy within Dale Talon's circle. He obviously was brought to the team by owner Vinny Viola, and I think he's a young guy, a very smart guy, a very good hockey mind. And, I think that he's been more quiet than maybe, you say that, people aren't talking about. Well, I think that might be by design. I think they wanted to kind of move away from that whole Tom Rowe thing. I mean, the Florida Panthers want to act like that year never happened. Like, do not bring up that whole thing because it was a mess. If you bring it up, you're like, oh, another history lesson, huh, George? It's like, you can't just wipe that off the map. I think Eric Joyce has worked his way through that. I think he's a big part of the Florida Panthers front office. He's with the team all the time when he's not in Springfield. And, if you see Dale, most times you see Eric right with him. So, that could be something moving forward.
Is that still the plan, to the best of your knowledge? I mean, who knows how long Dale Talon's going to be in that position. Is that still long-term the plan for the Panthers, is for Joyce to take over that GM position to the best of your knowledge?
Well, I believe that would be an answer, that really only owner Vinny Viola knows, because I think, he's got right now, Dale Talon is in charge of hockey operations and everybody answers to him. But Dale, as you know, is a very open guy and every idea is welcomed. I think that when Dale wants to say sayonara and hit the golf course full time again, I think they're going to have a meet, they would sit down and discuss that. So to say that's the plan, I don't know if it is or not. It may just be. But I think that, that's something that Dale and Vinny Viola are going to talk about when the time comes.
Stewie.
Looks like we're going to have NHL players at the next Olympics. And, with that comes all the mock rosters. And on the outside looking in with regards to the top nine is Jonathan Huberdeau. You get to see him on a day-to-day basis. Do you think he gets enough respect when it comes to, top players in the conversation, the top players in the world?
He's starting to, right? I mean, we've always, the last couple of years we've talked about how underrated Sasha Barkov is because nobody gets to see him in the playoffs. And the same goes for Jonathan Huberdeau. Last year he had 92 points, a career high. This year he was going to eclipse that. He would have been, probably a 100-point player. And that'll get you some attention. This year was his first year as an all-star. So I think Jonathan Huberdeau is starting to get that attention. And when you see these mock lineups for Team Canada in 2022, every single one has Jonathan Huberdeau, whether they've got him on the top line or somewhere else. He's a guy that you're looking at Team Canada as a lock for that team, and he should be. I mean, he's a terrific facilitator. Now that he's shooting the puck, he's got a great shot, and he scores. And, I think that was always the knock on Jonathan Huberdeau, was that he was always looking to pass first. And when you're playing with Sasha Barkov and Jenny Dadonov, that's okay. But when they've moved him to other to other lines, he's had to carry that. And for the first time, really, he's been able to do that. So he's definitely grown into quite a nice NHL player and one of the better players in the league.
Justin?
George, tell us a little bit about the unique experience of covering the Florida Panthers. I know it sounds like you know Stewie. You've been doing it for a lot of years there in Florida, and now you're doing it with Florida Hockey now. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that endeavor and just, as I said, what the experience is like covering sort of a non-traditional hockey market.
Well, it's a non-traditional sports market, right, Stewie? I mean, South Florida is... You know, it's one of those markets where everybody's from somewhere else, and, you know, international soccer as a whole may be more popular than anything in South Florida, you know, going. Even the Dolphins, you know, when they get those international soccer games at Joe Robbie Stadium, there's 80,000 people in the building, and you can't get a ticket. So, you know, it's just one of those markets where, you know, the Panthers haven't really done themselves any favors over the last 20 years. They've only made the playoffs a handful of times. They haven't won a playoff series since that third season in 1996. That was a generation ago. So, you know, they've kind of been lost by the wayside a little bit, and that's just how that market is. You have to win, you know, to have any sort of success. And I think that, you know, in covering that team, you have to realize that and realize that the Panthers do have a diehard base. They do have fans that love this team. And I think even the fans, you know, on the side of the road pay attention to the Panthers, but they want to see them win. If this team wins, you know, and I've, you know, we've been saying this for years, when the Florida Panthers win, they'll be a success in South Florida. We haven't seen them do that. Owner Vinny Viola, that was one of his things. Let's see what we got here. Let's put a winning team on the ice and let's see what we got as far as the fan base goes. And I think that, you know, once they do that, you know, I think good things will happen. You look at the Miami Heat, you know, they've struggled for a long time. And then they put up, you know, quite a nice run of success, and now they can do no wrong. You know, the Miami Heat next year could win 15 games, and people are still going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Panthers don't have that. So they just have to start winning and do it consistently, not just, you know, every 5 years or so.
George, we're talking to George Richards, talking about the Florida Panthers. George, one of the we mentioned Eric Joyce, and that story has kind of been silent. You say that that's by design the last past couple of seasons. You know, one of the great stories that hasn't really had much, hasn't really seen the light of day much this season at all is the improved play or the improved development, however you want it, maturation, I'm not sure. But Aaron Ekblad has had himself a fantastic season. Like, he does not look like the Aaron Ekblad, albeit there were concussion issues coming out of the World Cup. He does not look like that younger Aaron Ekblad that some people, you know, even had the nerve to write off and say, well, you know what, that's going to be a bad contract and a tough pick for the Florida Panthers. I think Ekblad's had a heck of a season. Every time I watch Florida Panthers games, he was one of, if not the guy, that always jumped out at me. What's the difference with Ekblad this year?
First off, I completely agree with you. I think Aaron Ekblad has had a quietly great season. He's their number one defenseman, as, you know, he should be. I mean, he was the number one pick of the draft. And he's really just growing and maturing into this role. I think being coached by Joel Quenneville, when you talk to Aaron Ekblad and you bring up what does having Joel Quenneville mean to you, and he just goes off like almost to the point that he gets emotional talking about it, because he's being coached by, you know, one of the best in the league, and he, you know, he says he wants to be a sponge, and he has done that. He's been working hard off the ice, working on his skating and things of that nature, and he's really had a very good year. As far as, you know, expectations and stuff, you hear it all the time. Oh, he's a bust. You know, they never should have. No, I mean, this, you know, you don't get a blue chip defender. You don't pass that up because they're so hard to get. And, you know, he's turned into one of the cornerstone players of the Florida Panthers.
Stewie?
What do you think's clicked for Evgeny Dadonov the second time around? I remember when I was in the organization back in 2008-09 when he first came over, he struggled a little bit. So what happened? Was it more of a maturation process, or he just turned into a good player?
Not rooming with you.
I think the talent was... That could have been, too. There was always the talent there, right? I mean, he was, you know, I remember one year he was the only all-star representative of the Panthers. You know, it was one of the, I think it was, one of the first years he was there. He was a rookie. And it just never clicked. I mean, I think going to the KHL, getting some confidence, maturing into more of a two-way player. The Panthers liked what they saw. I mean, Dale Tallon traded him away, I think, in 2010, and then re-signs him, and you know, 7 years later or whatever. I think Dadonov is, you know, he's a mature hockey player now, and knows his role. Obviously, can score. He's put up the numbers in each of his 3 years with the Panthers, and he's a guy that they can move up and down the lineup. Now, most of the time, he plays with Barkov and Huberdeau, and that is a great line. But when that goes a little stale, they move him down, and he still finds success. So, I think it was, you know, I think he grew up a lot. You know, he didn't like being shuttled back and forth. What was it? San Antonio was the AHL team then. He didn't enjoy that. And it showed, and he says, you know what, I'm going to go home, I'm going to play in the KHL. And as he got older and as he learned, you know, to be a professional, he's really turned into one, a really good player and a really good guy in the locker room as well. A lot of guys really love having his mentorship, and I don't think any of us would have said that, you know, back in 2008, 2009, whenever it was.
Justin, last one to you.
George, I was looking at the Panthers lineup, projected lineup for that first round series today, and one name stuck out to me in the top line, of that being Frank Vetrano, who, so I was in the AHL in 2015-16 when he was there. He scored 36 times in 36 games. He was 15th in the league in shots despite not even playing 40 games. Yeah. He was an unbelievable goal scorer, but it didn't seem to translate to the NHL until last year. Last year he scores 24 times. This year he's on pace for that or better. What's changed with his game to make him a top-line NHL player?
Well, part of it's opportunity, right? I mean, he was, you know, in the Boston organization and didn't feel like he got the chance. He was with the Bruins but was a healthy scratch, you know, 9 out of 10 times. He gets traded to the Panthers and kind of catches fire. And then last year had a terrific year, gets an extension. And, the guy can score. The guy can shoot. The guy can score. He's one of the best skaters on the team, if not the best skater on the team. The guy can absolutely fly. And he's, you know, a good teammate. The guys love ragging on him, you know, kind of like they did with Vincent Trocheck, and good-natured stuff, and he's good with everybody. And I think just, you know, having the opportunity to play, when he came to Florida, the Panthers, I think, put him on a line with Vincent Trocheck up on the second line. That was an opportunity that he hasn't had since the AHL. He picked up and ran with it, and you know, that's been a pretty nice move for the Panthers because they were able to lock him in on a 4-year deal. And, you know, he got off to a slow start this year, but really picked it up and was playing well. And, you know, he's a key guy moving forward for them. Definitely a top six player.
Listen to more of Hockey Central weekdays from noon to 2. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Smith and Jones.
If we project now to the restart of the NBA season, and thus that pushes next season to at least December 1st, if not December 25th, and some have even rumbled maybe January 1st, 2021, that then pushes the NBA calendar. And as you and I have talked about, there are a lot of people within the league, whether it be the league offices in New York, or whether it be, you know, board of governors around the league and presidents and general managers, that have really kind of been pushing this idea, even before COVID, pushing the idea of perhaps changing the calendar and changing the season. So if we go based on instead of starting on October 15th or 20th, we're now starting on, let's say, December 25th, you're starting the season 2 months later. So now instead of ending on April 15th, you're ending on June 15th. So now instead of the finals ending on June 15th, your season is ending in the middle of June, which means your season's now not going to end till middle of August, late August at the earliest, draft in September, off-season September, October, November, back into camps December, season starting December. Point being, in a very long-winded way, I apologize. What about cities like Toronto, Chicago, Boston, all these cold-weather cities that I'm talking about where, yeah, okay, you got to deal with January, February, starts warming up in March, spring coming back into April, warmer temps into May, stifling into June, July. Could that ultimately play into the favor of some of these, you know, eastern seaboards, northeastern cities where weather is not much of a draw or a factor in some of those southern states where you want to be down in Phoenix or Texas or Florida in June, May, June, July, August? I mean, I wonder how much weather could ultimately factor into some of these guys' decisions. Or is it just money and taxes?
I tell you, I think if weather factors in, it puts places like Toronto in a better light. Yeah. We didn't hear any complaints about Toronto last year during the finals, did we? Because people were here in May and June. And I always say this, talk to the baseball players about Toronto. Yes. Why? Because they come in April and they leave in October or November. They're here during the warmest time, the best time. I mean, you know, before COVID, to me, before and when I was covering the Jays, there was nothing like a weekend series against take anybody, the Tigers, the Yankees, heck, even a Western team that would come in against the Texas Rangers or somebody. You go down to the ball yard on a Friday night, the roof is open, you're sitting there. I mean, for me, it was work, but, you know, you're sitting in the stands. Toronto it's a great city, and people, the weather around the NBA gets too much play. Yeah, I know it was minus 9,000 when they were here for All-Star Weekend, but was it any warmer the year before in New York? And was it any warmer this year in Chicago? Absolutely not. So I think there's too much, as you said, in that case of, you know, the weather being part of it. And let's face it, like I said, with the baseball players, we heard no complaints in May and June last year when the world was here for the NBA finals and everybody was like, wow, what a great city. What a great place. Well, yeah, just like anywhere else when the weather's warm. So don't throw that at me because that's not something that you can control.
Well, and who did I read yesterday? I saw something on Twitter where there, I believe it might have been a former Jay. Somebody in baseball said, listen, if you think guys are going to come to Toronto and just sit in their hotel room, fat chance. And I think that's going to be the problem. We addressed this yesterday or the day before when we were talking about the hockey bubble and what's being constructed, at least in Toronto, in terms of this sort of village in a sense or the tenting and whatnot that's going up on the exhibition grounds down near BMO Field and whatnot. My concern about the NHL and baseball certainly it's more of a concern, is guys just simply staying in their rooms. Because I think it's, in theory, easier for the NBA to say, we are behind closed doors in a lockdown, essentially gated community, where you still have access to going for walks, going golfing, doing things within the confines of the four walls of Disney World, of the wide world of sports area or complex. But to tell somebody to go in hockey or especially in baseball, yeah, you're going to land in the city, you're going to drive to the hotel, and you're not going to leave. You're not going to wander any of the streets. You're not going to do anything at all. I have my doubts or my questions about that. And fingers crossed. I'm not trying to be the cynic, the skeptic. I'm just saying I have my doubts, and I hope that this all goes off without a hitch when we all get back. Because the other thing, too, is as slow as this process has been, Jonesy, it's happening in a real hurry. I mean, we're talking about playing regular season games now in baseball in the next couple of weeks. Basketball is only 3 weeks away. Hockey a couple of weeks away as well. I mean, for as long as it took to get it going, it's going to start up, and we're going to be in it before you can blink.
Yeah, no, I know, Eric, and that's – I mean, it's funny. We were talking about Toronto there. I mean, I know we're going to talk to Alvin here, and he's a guy, as he told us last week, this resonated with me, you know, a guy from Philly that comes to Toronto and – you know, kind of figures out the landscape, and then all of a sudden, wow, you know, Toronto's this great place that he never knew before, and it's got a different vibe, and he's trying to get that across to other people, and it's a great city in that sense. And you know what, you're right. I can't see the NHL guys, maybe for lack of a better term, behaving themselves in that sense. They're going to have fun. Toronto's a great city in that regard.
Well, you mentioned that he's going to join us, and he's on the line right now from Philadelphia, Sportsnet analyst, longtime NBA player, of course, longtime Raptor, Alvin Williams. Al, appreciate the time today.
Thanks for having me. This is just starting to be fun for me, man. How you guys doing?
It's your regular, man. You're on the payroll now, bro.
Hey, well, I don't know about that, but hey, one step at a time.
Yeah, Thursdays with Alvin. Alvin's going to be joining us regularly on the show, so we'll make sure we send a sub sandwich his way or something. Listen,
that's all I need.
Yeah, I'm sure. Speaking of food, I wasn't even going to start here, but have you seen some of the pictures rolling around about the food that some of these guys are eating down in the bubble down in Orlando? Have you seen any of this?
I haven't.
Okay, it doesn't look
so good. Looks like Eric's boxed lunch.
Yeah. it looks like my box lunch. It looks like something you might be getting on an airplane on a commercial flight or something. How much of a concern, Al, do you think it will ultimately be once guys get there? I mean, there's no way for you to know this with certainty, I know, but in theory, you can sit here and say, you know, as I would, all right, I'm willing to go, and I want to go, and I respect that I've got a job to do, and I want to play the game, and I love the game, and okay, yeah, you know what, I'm comfortable being away from my family or my friends, and I'm going to be in the hotel room. But suddenly you get there, and after 2 days or 2 weeks, how tired do you think it can get sitting in that hotel room, eating your pre-made meals and prefixed menus and whatnot, and just kind of living this sort of camp life, campus life, you know, going back to when you were a high school or younger?
It's going to be very soon. It's not going to be even weeks. It's going to be a few days, because, you know, you have people already going there being skeptical. And if you throw somebody off, they're already going to be thrown off of their norm. But if you keep somebody off of their norm with no semblance of anything that they're used to, you run a risk of rejection. And it's like, I take it back to, you know, when I first stopped playing, and when you go to, you're at the Ritz-Carlton's and you're at the Four Seasons, and, you know, I got a scouting job, and I was in Iowa, and I remember, what the hell, what hotel is this? Like, one day I was ready to get out of there, because my normal, when I traveled, when I did things, I was used to this. So I think even with this, hopefully the NBA considered, once again, I go back into the mindset of the athlete. It's not just, these guys just aren't robots. They're not just, you know, people you just gonna get out there to play basketball and just make sure economically things start to make sense, so you recover as much as you recover. You have to tap into their mental. You have to tap into what's gonna make these guys be as comfortable as possible, so we can make this the best situation as possible for all. And if you don't do that, from the nutrition side to the entertainment side, to the understanding of, you know, your family's not there, if you don't do those things or consider those things from a league or for a certain organization, you run a risk of people rejecting what you're ultimately trying to do. And that's going to bring harm to everyone.
Al, in that same sense, and I know you probably played with people like this at a different level I did. When things are off, it throws everything off. I mean, you know, I'm sure you know some guys, if they don't get new socks at the start of the game, they you know, something's wrong. Their mental state is off. How much does this bubble stuff, and, you know, we're hearing about they can book golf on every day but Saturday, and after a while there'll be parties of up to 35 that can go on like rides or to one of the areas of Disney, Animal Kingdom, or, you know, Test Track, the ride or whatever. But for guys that are wired differently, Al, when they're off, how much does that translate over to the court? How much does that translate onto the court where a guy, his focus isn't there because there's other stuff going on?
Oh, that's a serious issue. You know, some people, they play better when they're out hanging out. You know, some people, just as some people play better when they're, you know, they get more rest. You know, people may say, nah, it's no possible way. But I had one teammate, I won't say his name. I remember when we made it to the playoffs, and one of them just said, hey, whatever your routine was, make sure you stick to it. Don't start changing up because you're in the playoffs now. If you guys are hanging out, whatever you guys are doing, that doesn't change. You stick to the script. You stick what makes you be able to perform the way you've been performing. So a lot of people get into a ritual. A lot of people, you know, they have their superstitions, but they, more importantly, they do have their routine. And sometimes a routine is getting a certain meal. Sometimes it's your favorite restaurant, whether you're at home or whether you're on the road. People have favorite things they like to visit and like to take part of prior to the games. And you get such into that mode that you do feel like it helps your game at times. So I'm not a therapist. I'm not a doctor by any means. But those are certain circumstances that I've seen in the past that players definitely, they behave a certain way when it comes prior and to after games.
Speaking with Alvin Williams, Al, let me stay on that theme for a second then. Even when it comes down to the rituals, the routine, the habits that you talk about, when it comes to what time you wake up at, what time you go to bed at, when you're eating your food, when you're getting your nap, and whatever it may be, how difficult of an adjustment do you think that will ultimately be, at least in the initial stages, when we're going to be seeing games playing, from my understanding, at like noon, 2 o'clock, you know, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, et cetera. We're scattering 4 or 5 games over the course of the day for at least those 8 regular season games, and then let's see what happens come playoff time. But, you know, it's one thing to say teams will have a handful of games at 1 o'clock on a weekend or something during the season, but to be tipping off games at noon on a Wednesday or something, and with limited practice and limited shoot-arounds because of limited space available for all of the teams to get in their proper time, how much does that all factor into what you're talking about?
I mean, it can. It definitely can. I think it won't be that – I mean, I can't say it won't be that big of a deal, but it reminds you of summer league, right? You have these type of games. You have these type of scenarios. You guys mentioned high school, the AAU tournament. It's back to that element. And I think the one – thing that's in favor for the idea and the concept is everyone has to go through it. Like, everyone is inconvenienced. Everyone is not just, you know, so that conversation, yeah, you'll bitch and moan amongst each other, but guess what? We all have to do it. We all have the same access to the meals. We all have the same schedules. So maybe that will be something that will be an overriding thing when it comes to, like, the pushback. But also, I believe that these players ultimately – I need to know how well and how intent they're going to be when they're actually playing. You know, that's the other element, right? Are you taking these games at 12 o'clock the same as you would normally take the 7 o'clock primetime game or you know, whatever the case may be? I think that's the element. But I think overall, as long as these players are, you know, going through the same experiences and the same, and they're afforded the same opportunities as everyone else, and not one person getting this and one person getting that or one team vice versa, I think the players should be on board where they'll be able to perform on the same playing field, even playing field.
Al, when you look at guys performing, I mean, it's kind of like coming out of a training camp, and at the same time, there's no time to ease into stuff. You've got, you know, a couple scrimmages, then 8 games, then bang, you're playing for a championship. All of a sudden, the games are, you know, I wouldn't say more important, but they're it's you're getting down to win or go home time. Talk to me about the adjustment period for a guy like Chris Boucher, who's put on weight and is trying to learn to play with that, or Marc Gasol, who's gone the other way. Like, what do you see? Like, I mean, when you come back to camp in September, October, when you were a player, and you look at a guy and you go, wow, he's changed his body. What kind of adjustment does that force for him and for his teammates going forward?
Well, you know, I think in the summertime, when the last day you leave your organization and you go to wherever you go to and get prepared for the next season, however you do it, you're doing that. So when you come into that next season, this is the result. And yeah, you like, if you're a Marc Gasol, you're going to walk in there. You're going to, like, I, for instance, I remember when Kyle Lowry, you know, transformed his body and all the work that he put in that summer. Like, he came to camp looking for results, looking for, you know, people to recognize that. But ultimately, the result of him becoming a better player, being more, having more endurance, being more durable,
So that was the motive for that. This way, it just happened such out of the blue. People, I think, were so bored, or people just figured out that they can just do things without really understanding or really out, not knowing the purpose of why they're doing stuff. So it's one of those things where I think the players will be able to adjust. I don't think it will impact their playing that much. I think, once again, it's so much uncertainty and so many things in the air that I don't know what the players' agendas are or what their motives were by doing this, because I think a lot of players didn't think they were ever going to play again this season. And I think now that they're in position, they have to readjust. And it may be, once again, I tap into the mental side, being able to readjust and really getting yourself in a mode where I got to play all out, because this actually does mean something. I know it's the summertime, but this actually does mean something, and we're going for a championship. I think that mindset set in that transition of understanding that this juncture of the season is not normally played with this much intent behind it. So I think they have to adjust to that and then really get out there and play hard. Now, does that lead to injuries, or does that lead to other things? I don't know. But mentally, I think, once again, that's going to be the biggest adjustment that they're going to have to fight through. How hard are they going to play? Are they going to play all out every possession, every time? Because now this is the part of the season where, you know, this is coming into postseason. Everything means something, as you mentioned, Jonesy. So that's going to be the challenge, I think, for all of them.
Speaking with Alvin Williams, Al, when we think about the competitive balance, you know, I'm by no means going to criticize anybody that has decided to not play for personal reasons, whether it be themselves or family, whatever it may be. That's their prerogative. But when we factor in guys that have decided to not play for personal reasons or because of injuries, whatever it may be, no team stands out more right now than the Brooklyn Nets. No Kevin Durant, no Kyrie Irving, no Wilson Chandler, no DeAndre Jordan, no Spencer Dinwiddie. Now they've gone and signed Jamal Crawford, Michael Beasley. I don't even know. I mean, I could ask you 9 different questions on this, Al, but when it comes to the competitiveness, when it comes to the fairness, when it comes to, you know, the angling for positioning for playoff seeds and whatnot, what do you make of A, what's happening with Brooklyn, and how that then B, impacts so many other teams in the East that might be licking their chops trying to get at this club?
Man, you said it, E, and we all said, this is, to me, an AAU situation, a camp situation. It's like you can wake up one day on Monday, think you're going to play against the number one point guard in the nation, and they're not playing, or they decided not to come to camp, or their AAU team, and you never know who you're playing against. The team may not be as good as you thought they were supposed to be coming from New York, and you're playing against the best Philadelphia team. There's so much uncertainty when it comes to these scenarios, and I think this is a sample size of it. I think some of these teams, you got, you know, like a Brooklyn Net, they came into this season, you think about it, it's one of these, you know, could be an upsetter, right? But, of course, they had, you know, KD and Kyrie not playing, but this is a team that was on a rise. And now you have most of their best players not playing. So what does it mean if you beat the Brooklyn Nets or a team wins a championship when a lot of the teams may not have pieces or elements to their team that made them that same dangerous team that we thought from the beginning of the season? So what does it really all mean? Like the new, and even if you take it the other way, if Brooklyn, if they succeed and they win with Jamal and Beasley, all right, does that team that just beat the Lakers in a championship, is that the Brooklyn Nets team that signed early on? So what does everything at the end of, what's the end result with all of this? Is it the ultimate championship? Well, I don't understand. So there's a lot of uncertainty once again, but it takes a lot. It runs the risk of taking a lot of credibility away from a championship or a great performance when some of these teams aren't the same makeup as they were from the beginning of the year.
Al, I got one more for you. I know we're kind of getting up against the clock here for time, but how quickly can a team change its fortunes? I mean, you know, a regular NBA season, there's time. If you're not playing well and, you know, it's the middle of December or the middle of January, you still got time to pick it up and you still have time to improve. And I look at the Raptors. They improved from the start of the playoffs last year to the end. They just kept getting better and better. You're in a short window now. You're playing the turnover is quick. You're playing frequently. If things are going sideways – how quickly can you turn it around? Or the other way, if you're rolling, how difficult are you to take down? Because the games are coming so fast and furious, and there's not a lot of time to practice in between.
Yeah, I mean, it is going to be difficult, and it's going. But I also think that's the exciting part. It's going to kind of I think back to baseball. Like, it doesn't seem like the best team always wins. It's like a team that's why I could never follow baseball pretty much, because I'm like, I thought this team stunk, and that's the team that ended up winning the World Series. I'm like, how the heck? So it's like the team that gets hot, or an NCAA tournament. It's a team that, you know, gets hot, gets the lucky bounce, and, you know, have the uncertainty. You just never know. That's why it's beautiful, because it's just not the guaranteed best team. And I don't think the best team on paper, whether it's the Milwaukee Bucks or the Los Angeles Lakers or the Clippers, will walk away easily winning a championship, because there's so many other elements. But it's going to be difficult, to your point, Jonesy, that, you know, they may be, if you get on a rut, if you get in a rut, how do you get out of that rut with no practice time, or not the continuity with certain players being able to play? Or if you're on a roll, you know, that could be a plus. But I think these games could go either or. It's going to be rare, I think, to see multiple teams go on many streaks of winning streaks, or whatever the case may be, or something like that. So once again, it's so much uncertainty, but I think that the uncertainty could be the excitement as well.
Listen to more of Smith and Jones weekdays from 1 to 2. Coming up, more Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Writer's Block.
The Toronto Blue Jays formally announced that they have signed Scott Boras' client Austin Martin to a club record $7,825,000 signing bonus. It was, of course, the fifth pick overall in the 2020 draft. And, you know, Stephen, every time we see a draft, some team always says we can't believe that guy fell to us. In the case of the Toronto Blue Jays, there were about 25 other teams that couldn't believe Austin Martin fell to them as well. A lot of teams had him going second. Of course, the Baltimore Orioles didn't take him second. He is the founder, owner, and president of the Boras Corporation. He is Scott Boras. Scott, thank you so much for joining Stephen Brunt and myself on Writer's Block. We trust you're doing well. Tell us a little bit about what obviously the Blue Jays will let us know at some point, but what do you think the organization's plans for Austin will be? This is an unusual year, not just because of the way the schedule has been interrupted by COVID-19, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes as well, but because the minor leagues aren't in operation. So what do you think the Jays' plans for Austin would be?
Well, in most organizations, I know with Torkelson, and they took them to their 60-man camp, and they're working them out and really getting to know the player. I think that's something that Ross is probably contemplating, and you know, I think we wanted to get through the signing process and get all that completed, and then I think they're going to decide what they're going to do from there.
Was this a tough sign in any way, Scott? Was it a tough negotiation in any way? Were there any complications involved?
No, I think this was a pretty special situation for the Blue Jays, in the sense it kind of reminded me of Mark Teixeira, where he was really one of the top players in the draft, and he fell to a club that you would not normally expect to get them. And Austin is a player that in the past drafts it could have likely been the number one pick in the draft. He is a unique player because he, like Chris Bryant, is so versatile, because he can play infield and outfield positions and do it with great comfort, and plus his bat has that kind of power that you would expect more from a larger player, more of a corner outfielder, and yet he's got infield size. So, we call it dirt power, and it's pretty rare for a player to have dirt power, and I think the Blue Jays got themselves something pretty special here.
Scott, when the Blue Jays made this pick, and again, we talked before you came on a bit about a lot of the draft, you know, a lot of the draft, the pre-draft conversation was he would go two and maybe go three. Now, I understand that a lot of people will say, well, there's not a great deal of difference between two and five, but there is a little bit of difference financially. And there's also, you know, when you've been told you're going to go a certain place or somebody is going to likely pick you in a certain spot, there is, I'm not going to say you're going to be disappointed necessarily, but I'm just wondering initially on draft day, you know, what, because we haven't had a chance to talk to him, what Austin's reaction was when that second pick came and went and he was, you know, when he was still on the board.
Well, this is something we know. We're in communication with all the clubs, and it's not, draft day is really not a surprise to the players so much. Sometimes you, I think the bigger surprises are that the clubs that you know are on the same plane as the player is about his value, and they have to make decisions. And some clubs are going to go by positions because their relative need for position players versus pitching is really a dominant consideration in the draft, particularly if there's quality on both sides. So if you see an organization that you know is really lacking in pitching depth, it's unlikely that a very, very good position player would be chosen knowing that there's a very, very good pitcher there. So with those considerations, you kind of have an indication what organizations are heavy on position players or pitching. And so it's rather predictable within a club or two, I would say.
Yeah, Scott, you've been forthright about your opinion about the direction the Toronto Blue Jays organization and ownership were taking. You wasn't that long ago you were talking about them having the blue flu and not maybe being able to spend in accordance with the size of their market. You've concluded two pretty significant negotiations with this organization in the last few months with Ryu and now with Martin. What are your current thoughts about the direction this organization and this ownership is taking?
Well, Mark and Ross have done a really good job of building a foundational core where they literally have a middle of a lineup that includes players who can play the infield. And that, when you see that in a club where you're going to get middle lineup potential with players who can really fulfill infield spots, that is something that most clubs in baseball don't have. And it also opens the door for you to get slugging players, corner outfielders that are often more available in free agency than infielders. And I think it gives you an opportunity then to say that I can really hunt on major free agent pitching. And I know that my club is going to be both financially within a lane because I have 6-5 years of control over major middle lineup bats. So I am able to really keep a budgetary assessment of a team in line with very reasoned standards for a good period of time. And also get key free agent components that allow the team to be immediately competitive. So I would say right now the Blue Jays are really in an excellent position going forward here for the next 5-6 years.
In a lot of ways, Scott, it's kind of like the Chicago Cubs, what the Cubs did, is it not? Sort of getting that position, young position player core. A lot of guys were middle infielders, maybe shift a guy to the outfield. And then, as you say, spend money in free agent pitching. It seems to be almost a similar, at least from a distance, a similar tack.
Well, you have to have the draft cooperate with you because mm-hmm. the talent is so rare to get power that can play in the infield. They got Bryant and they got Baez. And so right. when you're looking at those two players, that fits that model. And then you were also, but they also were able to trade for Rizzo. They drafted Almora as well. and got an immediate, you know, center field type player. So they've really been able to. But remember, too, to win, they spent $500 million in free agency.
Correct.
Because they went out and spent on Hayward. They spent on Lester. They spent on Zobrist. They made a very serious commitment in free agency and they did a great job of trading for Addison Russell and Rizzo to complement it. So they used all three forces of baseball, trade and the draft and free agency. But the core of that was getting those draft picks that truly had unique skill that gave you middle line of bats and played in the infield. And that's the similarity that I think Mark and Ross have really been able to attain here in the last couple of years.
Scott, the last time we had you on the show was in the middle of those contentious negotiations between the PA and the commissioner's office over the restart and the terms of the restart, the back and forth, you know, which ended obviously with going back to the March agreement and the 60 days of prorated salary, 60 games of prorated salary, and the commissioner saying at a certain point after that they only ever intended to play 60 games, which, you know, smacked of bad faith to some people. You're in contact with some pretty significant, your clients are some of the most significant players in the game, obviously. What is the mood of the players right now in terms of the restart?
Well, the players reached a good faith agreement with the March 26th agreement and literally gave up half their salaries. And fully expected to play and create a roadmap for this that would have allowed, certainly as contemplated in the agreement, playing without spectators. And, you know, we should have clearly had this accomplished by, if not the middle of June, the 1st of July, and had a 100-game schedule. The shocking admission by the commissioner illustrated exactly what their plan was from the start, that they had no intentions of ever playing 100 games and giving the fans a competent season. They wanted to provide a college season, if you will, a 60-game season, because of their economic dynamic that they wanted to fulfill. And I'm a believer that there should be two bodies in baseball. One should be the judicial branch, if you will, and that is labor lawyers who are there to enforce the rules, and they're there to legislate and mandate new rules to protect the integrity of the game. But as far as when you ask labor lawyers to be business operators, when you ask them to be business operators, you get things like this. And it's something to me that really hurts the game, and I think it was unfortunate.
Are you and or your clients concerned about the kind of stumbling start to the testing program?
What I'm most excited about, Jeff and Steven, is that we started this with such an amazing low percentage of players that were that tested positive in the first place. Because I think they had 1.2% included coaching staffs. And so the player community was less than 1%. So when you start off like that and you have such an amazing amount of your performance community, we only have to look to the Asian models in Korea and Taiwan and Japan to see that the operation of baseball with no fans, once everyone is tested negative, has been quite clear. There's not been one hospitalization. It's been done rather safely. And so I'm really encouraged by this early result and that we've had so many of the players report without incident, and that the detection aspect of this that we've been able to accomplish has come early. And obviously there's going to be some hiccups here on testing as far as how you finally determine when a player is ready to return. But overall, we've had really a very, very great start in getting a huge volume of players are ready to play baseball within 15 days.
Should mention, by the way, that Charlie Montoyo, the Blue Jays manager, has just said that Austin Martin is going to be added to the 60-man player pool.
Listen for more of Writer's Block weekdays from 2 to 5. Coming up, more Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Leadoff with Ziggy and Scotty Mack.
Josh Cloak from The Athletic covers TFC. Josh, MLS last night, the debut of the tournament in Orlando. There've been all kinds of hiccups already. I have to ask you this question first. Where in the pecking order, because George alluded to this, where in the pecking order of soccer leagues on earth does MLS sit?
It's a top 10 league for sure. It's kind of in that murky, 7 to 10 range. I mean, obviously we know the big five in Europe are kind of indisputable. And then you've got, the Portuguese league, the Russian league, the Brazilian league kind of on the fringe. But, MLS has done a pretty good job over the last few years of developing young players and then selling them on to bigger leagues around the world. So, they deserve credit there. And they still manage to attract big name talent. Some would accuse these players of being aging players. But, if you can attract the Zlatans of the world, the Chicharitos of the world, these are still big name players in their own right. I put it somewhere in that 7 to 10 range. You're right. The quality of the soccer, the problem, without getting too deep in the weeds here, the problem with MLS is teams are very top-heavy. They bring in great attacking talent from around the world, and sometimes their defenders are straight out of U.S. colleges. So, they have these unbalanced teams. But I agree with whoever said earlier that, the product last night, the first 45 minutes was pretty flat. You could tell that these were teams that were probably pretty apprehensive to take the field. And you had this, great, remarkable 8-minute and 46-second demonstration to start the match, which, also makes you start a match, thinking more about what's happening off the pitch than on the pitch. So I can understand why players probably weren't in the right headspace to start the match, but it pretty entertaining by the end. You guys were talking earlier about whether or not it's a good advertisement for Major League Soccer. It is, in the sense that, now there's an opportunity as the first male league to come back to get some eyeballs, but also a lot of questions about whether or not they even should be coming back right now, given what's happening in Florida, given what's happening with the team in Nashville, Dallas dropping out of the tournament. So a lot of questions, a lot of eyeballs, and a lot more questions than Major League Soccer is probably used to having, right?
And Carlos Vela skipping the tournament says something as well. Sure. So, again, George, we've discussed this, right? We've discussed that it's great to a degree that we have live sports, but George, Vela skipping the tournament isn't a great look for the league. And as you just said, there's already been a bunch of bumps in the road.
Yeah, and it's not just Vela. If we look here in Canada, the Vancouver Whitecaps had four players elect not to go, including, Canadian men's national team star Lucas Cavallini. He said he had two of his family members die of COVID-19, and he just didn't want to be part of it. And you almost wonder, too, if there were more players making those kinds of decisions a few weeks ago, if we would have seen even more players, because no one really wants to be the first one through the wall. Carlos Vela, the reigning MVP, electing not to go. His wife is pregnant, and he doesn't want to, come in contact with anybody that has COVID-19 and then, possibly infects his wife. It's scary. And you can get on these players for making these decisions, because I know there is a lingering sense of frustration within some senior MLS players, because, they feel like the plan that was presented to them, originally is not the plan that they have in front of them now, considering where Florida's cases are. So good on them for kind of stepping up and putting their health first and foremost for what could be, for a lot of teams that go there, three games and then that's it. Is that worth it? It's a decision every player has to make. But for me, I think I'd have to ask a lot of questions about whether or not, putting my long-term health would be worth it for the possibility of just a few games, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Josh. But when it comes to actually winning this tournament, we know that some of these group stage games will count towards regular season points if and when the regular season does resume. But winning the tournament not only gets you $1 million first prize, but it also gets you a spot in the CONCACAF Champions League. And that's the site of Toronto FC's most heartbreaking loss in the final of the CONCACAF Champions League a couple years ago. Is that something that is kind of a giant carrot here at the end of this tournament when a lot of people think it's kind of meaningless?
It is, and especially for teams that want to be there and think they can win it. You know, TFC's president, Bill Manning, a few weeks ago said that was their real driving force in this tournament, is getting that Champions League spot, getting back into that tournament. They didn't qualify for the tournament this year. They want to get back there. That's the one empty spot in their trophy case right now. They can still qualify for Champions League if they win the Canadian Championship, but there's still questions about whether or not that tournament is even going to happen this year. That's a big deal, and it's a big deal if you have the kind of team that's built for that. I mean, I would consider TFC to be one of the favorites in this tournament. You know, again, one of the two or three favorites with Carlos Vela out for LAFC, and they're kind of, you know, nobody would be surprised to see another Toronto-Seattle final in this tournament. TFC have a deep roster. They're bringing everyone available to Orlando, which is not something every team can say. So it's a big deal for TFC to win CONCACAF Champions League, to get that spot. Things start for them on Sunday.
Josh, you also cover the Leafs, and I want to touch base on what they look like going into this tournament, 2014 tournament, because that's what it is for all intents and purposes. It's another variation on what sports used to be as opposed to what sports are currently. And you look at the Maple Leafs against the Columbus Blue Jackets. The Blue Jackets have the advantage in mitigating shots and chances against. Their stats are significantly lower than the Maple Leafs numbers. The Jackets ranked fourth in goals against and sixth at 5-on-5 compared to the Leafs, who were 25th and 28th at 5-on-5 with 157 goals. How much of this series is going to hinge upon that Toronto Maple Leafs offense to be firing on all cylinders?
Well, that's pretty much the only way they can come out of this, right? And I think if you're the Leafs, you like that, though. You like that you're going to have an opportunity to kind of play that run-and-gun puck possession style that they've developed, you know, this season under Sheldon Keefe. And I think the Leafs are, you know, they're a hungry team right now. And let's not forget, they're getting kind of an interesting, I guess we can call him a bit of a trade deadline acquisition, and Nick Robertson, who's coming into the team and, you know, could slot into the third line. This is a 50-goal scorer in the OHL. And you know, scouts that I've spoken to believe that this is a player that can compete right away and score goals in the NHL right away. So, you know, the Leafs have one of the most potent offenses in the NHL, and to kind of get that injection of another quick scorer is going to be great for the team. So I like their chances, especially in a 5-game series, you know, where they can get hot for 2 games, and that could probably be enough to put them over the edge. Columbus is going to be healthy again, which really doesn't help the Leafs, but I would put this up there as one of the more intriguing matchups in this first round.
Josh, what does a rested Freddie Anderson mean for the Leafs in the playoffs for probably the first time as a Maple Leaf?
That's a really good question, and it's something that I think the Leafs are thinking a lot about, because, you know, on one hand, we look at how Freddie Anderson has performed in Octobers previously, and that's, you know, when he should be at his most rested, right, after a summer off. And statistically, it's really never that good. Freddie usually hits his stride in November. You know, November, Freddie is generally one of the best goaltenders in the NHL over the past few seasons. So, yeah, there's going to be questions about if he's coming in rested. Is that a really good thing? Or is he the type of goalie that needs to get a few games under his belt to really heat up? So I think the Leafs, you know, we're probably a little bit nervous about this, and I think that's probably a big reason why they made the addition of Jack Campbell that they did. I mean, if you get to a case where Freddie has an off game and you feel like maybe you need to go to the backup, obviously that's not going to boost Anderson's confidence at all. But if you feel you need to do that, they would feel a lot better going to Jack Campbell than they would, obviously, Michael Hutchinson. So I think that as much as there is cause for concern, I think they feel a lot better about the backup situation. So, yeah, that remains to be seen. But I do think that Freddie is the kind of goalkeeper who likes to get a few games under his belt. So perhaps if they can get through Columbus, he'll feel a lot better going into that second round, you know, the seven-game round. So, but that'll definitely be one to keep an eye on.
If the Toronto Maple Leafs don't advance to the conference final this year, is this season a failure?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it is. Here's the thing. It was one of the most dramatic seasons in recent memory for the Leafs. There was always an injury. There was a coaching change. You know, it was a very tumultuous season for the Leafs. But even amidst all of that, you know, I still believe that there's just so much talent on this team and the kind of talent that should allow you to win a round. You know, it's as much as, you know, we were just talking about Freddie Anderson, I'm pretty high on him. I think he is a top 10 goalie in the league. And when you have a goalie like that, you should be able to win a round. And, you know, as much as their defense has been the subject of scrutiny, there's still talent there too. And we don't need to talk about the talent up front. We know they're one of the best attacking teams in the league. When you have that much talent, it's just a matter of those pieces coming together. And if they don't, again, I don't know how you can call this season anything but that, right? As a failure, if you don't get past the first round, that's kind of, it's that mental hurdle too. You know, I think that if we can see this Leafs core get out of the first round for the first time, which they've been unable to do, I think you could, you know, maybe see them unleashed in a way, because it's obviously weighing on the minds of some of these players not being able to get out of the first round. But yeah, again, with the talent they have, I think not getting out of the first round is got to be considered a failure.
Listen to more of Leadoff with Ziggy and Scotty Mac weekday mornings from 6 to 9. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan.